Support for this podcast and the following message come from Corient. Corient provides wealth management services centered around you. They focus on exceeding your expectations and simplifying your life. Corient has been helping high achievers just like you enjoy their lives more fully, preserve their wealth, and provide for the people, causes, and communities they care about. As one of the largest integrated fee-only registered investment advisors in the U.S., Corient has deeply experienced teams in 23 strategic locations. Corient has extensive knowledge spanning the full spectrum of planning, investing, lending, and money management disciplines. Leverage Corient's exclusive network of experts to craft custom solutions designed to help you reach your financial goals, no matter how complex they may be. Real wealth requires real solutions. For more information, connect with a wealth advisor today at Corient.com. That's Corient.com. Corient.com.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Good morning. Welcome to Sawcast number 44. This production of Sawcast is brought to you courtesy of Jocko Willing Productions and his technical staff today, including Sergeant Terry Helton. And we want to talk about SOG, which is the secret war that went on for 8 years in Vietnam. And during that time, we learned many years later we had the highest casualty rate of the entire war, but we didn't know that while we were involved in the war. I'm going to turn to a chapter here from a book, Surrender, Not an Option. And I'm trying to get to the correct page. I think I may have to do a slight pause. Sorry about that.
You're forgiven.
Oh, thanks. I moved my page marker out beforehand. Sorry. Okay, here we go. Sorry about that delay. The team had been compromised. It was time to get out while the getting was still good. However, the helicopters had already reached the point of no return and were now committed to refuel. The team was on its own for an hour and a half to 2 hours. Purvis knew the accomplishment of the mission was out of question. Now, team survivability was paramount. He knew the trackers would soon be on his trail, followed by at least two squads of NVA soldiers and another tracker. So this is a quick portion from the book, Surrender Not an Option, by Gene Pugh, who ran recon out of CCN, and who I had the privilege of serving with, gosh, 55 years ago?
57.
Indeed. Whatever it was long, Gene, and welcome to the show, sir.
Thank you very much. It's an honor and a pleasure to be here.
So this book is dubbed fiction, but knowing you, it's based very much on your actually time on the ground. And you were on that team. And what was that like? The feeling of it's time to get out. You know the enemy's coming in after you. The helicopters had to go back and refuel.
It's a time of when your pucker factor gets real tight. It's about a pucker factor 10. You know you're going to be on your own for about an hour and a half. And right about that time, in this particular occasion, the talking sticks came into play.
And what was the year?
This is 1968.
Right.
And
And the talking sticks are?
The talking sticks is the Vietnamese version of the African drums, so to speak. And what they want to do is that they want to channel you. They want to channel you into an area where they're going to ambush you. And you know that you've been compromised, and they're going to challenge you, and they're going to challenge, channel you in this one particular area where they're going to hit you hard. And you have to remember that after initial contact, and you know this from your own experience, from first contact, you're going to be outnumbered 2, 3, 4, even 5 to 1 in less than 20 minutes. So you have to hit them hard. You're not going to do a stand. You're going to hit and run. Hit and run. Hasty ambushes all the way to the LZ. And you rely on instinct. You rely on your team. You rely on each other. You know that if you get yourself into a firefight and an enemy breaks through on your left flank, let's say, you know that your team leader, Tony or Phil Quinn at the time, was dead. If they broke through on the right flank or whatever flank you were on, they knew that I was dead. You held your ground, and that was it. The jungle to me was home. I was born and raised in Panama. So I had that instinct about reading the jungle. And of course, I passed this information on to my team leader. As a tail gunner, you had to cover the team's butt, so to speak. And we just did what we had to do. And we trained for it. And we trained for it. And we just continued the mission.
So for that team, even though we'll get away from the fictional side of the story, we're mentioning Tony Bandiera.
Yeah.
And, of course, Tony will be on Sawcast number 42. Mm-hmm. He was on Sawcast 42. And now you're 44, but Tony was there, and then Sergeant Quinn.
Sergeant Quinn, yes. Bill Quinn, yes.
And this is your first mission or second?
This was...
this is very early in your career.
This is very early. My first mission, I was a strap along. I was a strap hanger with a guy by the name of Hoot Gibson. He was an RT Anaconda.
Right.
Yeah. And I was in the message center at the time, and for some reason or other, he was looking for an American to go because his 1-1 was doing something else. And so I tagged along. And turned out to be it was a stay behind.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah, it was a stay behind. And so we went in, caused a lot of stuff on the way out, but there was 4 of us that stayed behind.
So explain a little bit more detail what that means.
Basically what it was, it was a ruse.
Right.
Where the helicopters would come in and the enemy would see helicopters come in and there would be movement getting on the helicopters, but just a small group of maybe 3 or 4 would stay behind, sneak back into the jungle, or not even get on the LZ, just stay back, and then collect intelligence.
So the idea being the NVA would see the helicopter leave
right
after a firefight, assume all those Americans have left with their recon team, they would go back to normal, they hoped.
They hoped.
And then you would be there collecting intel.
And telling intel. In fact, we were supposed to do a quick POW snatch, which did not go well.
All right, well, please tell us why.
Because Hoot did not tell us who we were going to capture. And so we both shot the same guy.
So going in, the concept was somebody was going to wound.
Right.
But you both wounded and thus wound up killing the poor little innocent NVA soldier.
Right. There were 3 of them. And so he didn't tell us which one we were going to capture.
Indeed.
It was a screw up.
So things got worse after that, I assume.
Oh, yes. Yeah.
So there's only 4 of you now.
Yeah. And so we were compromised and we went back to the LZ and we got picked up and that was it.
You were able to get picked up while under enemy gunfire, of course.
Oh, yes. Oh, yeah. We did not stick around. We did not stick around. We made our presence known, and we left. And that was it. That was it. We were gone.
Okay. So getting this other mission, was it then your second or your third? Yeah, you're with RT ASP at this point.
RT ASP was comprised of North Vietnamese.
Right.
We had Vietnamese in our camp. We had Nungs. We had Montagnards. Ours was, was the first team comprised of North Vietnamese. There were the old Thundercloud team. Thundercloud team came under Ops 34, which would send them up into North Vietnam or into Northern Laos to collect intelligence. But they figured that the intelligence that they were reporting was not
Many accurate. Teams were compromised or just wiped out.
And so they brought us back. They transferred Thundercloud over to Ops 35, which we were under. And Larry Trimble and Melville Westerfield were the first 1-0 and 1-1 to run with it. And then I joined the team later on in late October, early November of 68.
Wow.
So, yeah. And Tony had already been on the team.
Okay. And so for this particular mission that we start out with the book, where you guys are left behind, how'd that go and how did it pan out for you?
We got out of there very good. In fact, when the helicopter came in to pick us up, one of the helicopters got hit and lost power on the LZ. And so the other helicopters came in to pick it up. They were overloaded. And I ever see a Huey bounce along the LZ to get up.
Oh, yeah.
And it was very dramatic. A lot of gunfire going on. And we got out of there. Unfortunately, one of the door gunners.
It's KIA.
KIA.
Man.
It's not nice.
No, because you always hear about the helicopters coming to pick you up, but the great risk. That's why we have the aviators that we've interviewed talking about their side of the SOG missions, because they're the ones that pulled our teams out, kept us alive.
They had no place to hide. We had trees and rocks and what have you to hide, but they're out in the open. And
when they come into the LZ, it's a slow-moving target.
Slow-moving target, and they've got the biggest cojones.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Big cojones. hats off to them.
So, indeed. So, where did all this begin? How did you wind up in the Army, Special Forces, or SOG, being born in Panama City?
Oh, yeah.
Indeed.
I was born in Colón, Republic of Panama.
Yes.
I went to an American school, and I was in the junior ROTC program.
You and your brother together?
Yeah.
Yes.
And this was 1961-62 time period. Actually, the 62 time period. And 8th Group was just starting to appear in the Canal Zone. And, of course, we wanted to find out, who are these guys with the funny green beret? You know, who are they? And, that's Special Forces. You don't want to do that. Just wanted to know more about it. And then in 64, I read about Roger Donlan getting them. Medal of Honor.
Yeah.
And I'm going, oh my God. That is not. So I started doing a little bit more research on Special Forces, and then the book, The Green Beret, came out. And I was in North Texas State University, had put in my 4 years of college, had not graduated, did not get my degree because I failed typing.
What?
Yes, I failed typing.
You're that type of failure, are you?
Yes, I'm that type of failure, right?
Oh, my God.
So I failed typing. And so I was running out of money, and so I joined the Army. February of 1966. Went to Fort Polk, Louisiana for my basic. And when I was there, I think it was my second week, I was a trainee platoon sergeant. And I was at the PX, and I hear this voice behind me, Private Pugh. And I turned around, and all I could see was this gold bar on this helmet. And the second lieutenant is just tearing me a new butthole. I'm just shaking there. And then all of a sudden he goes, Gene, it's me, Steve. And it was this guy that I knew from North Texas State University. Don't recall his last name. And he goes, what are you doing here? And I says, well, what are you doing here? Straightens his helmet up, private pupils. I want to talk to you behind the PX. So we go behind the PX, and we talk about Army and generalities. And I tell him that Lieutenant Schoolcraft was talking to those of us that had college education and blah, 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 so on and so forth, becoming officers. Don't do it. Well, why not? You're not. Don't do it. Why? He said, look at the Army Times, which I did. And evidently it was a bad week for second lieutenants. Oh, my God.
These are all the KIAs.
The KIAs.
Yeah.
So I reported back to the first sergeant, and I said, sir, first sergeant, I would like to reconsider this option of becoming an officer. Why, Private Pugh? He says, I want to experience the Army more. He said, well, that's my boy. Yes, sir. Yes, sir. And I just became his best private right then and there. And if you recall, about the third or fourth week in basic training back in the time in 66, they had the in-service recruiters, remember
oh,
that?
Oh, sure, yeah.
Remember that? Had the paratroopers and SAS and helicopter recruiters there.
Don't forget the cooks.
Oh, yeah.
You'll and never go hungry.
That's right. And so then, at the end of the, I was on the stage, there was Sergeant First Class Lou Minor. 7th group, because he had the red flash. I'm here for volunteers for special forces. I need volunteers. So I raised my hand. About a week or so later, report to the first sergeant. I did. He says, Private Pugh, you are to get an airborne physical. He says, I don't recall volunteering for airborne. Says, Private Pugh, you volunteered for Special Forces, is that correct? Yes, sir. That's an airborne unit.
You forgot that detail?
I forgot that detail. He says, Private, there's only two things that fall out of the sky. That's bird shit and dumb shit. Now, which one are you? I guess I'm a dumb shit. Get the hell out of my office. Report to dispensary number 3.
Oh, my God.
So that was it. So I went through jump school and... in the summer, latter part of July, first part of July there.
At Fort Benning?
Fort Benning. And then reported into Fort Bragg training group there. And we must have had...
And wasn't there some culture shock involved in that?
Oh, good Lord, yes.
Going from the harassment, the verbal harassment, push-ups, running.
Oh, good Lord, yes. There was a captain, and he had the 173rd... combat patch, I'll never forget it. And he says, shake hands with the man on your left, shake hands with the man on your right. He says, two of you aren't going to be here.
No kidding.
Yeah. And he was right.
Wow.
We had about 250, 260 in the group there. And if memory serves me right, about 9 months later, there were 44 of us of the group, of the various groups, you know.
We're going to Special Forces.
Special Forces, right.
Okay, jumped out of jump school.
Right.
Okay.
And so getting our berets. And so that was it. I went to Charlie Company of the 6th after graduation, and I think that was the best thing for me because that's when the training really started. I got cross-trained as a medic, assistant medic. I was a radio operator, diddy-dum-dum-diddy.
Indeed.
Yeah. And then I was cross-trained in intel. And then we got cross-trained. I wouldn't say cross-trained, but we were trained in company tactics because we were all going to go to an A camp. That was the thing. You're going to go to an A camp. They didn't talk so much about the special projects because it was hush-hush.
Sure.
But it was, you're going to be going to an A camp. We're going to teach you here company tactics. Camp defense. They trained us in crew serve weapons, the weapons that you're going to be using there in the camp, how to sight a mortar, etc., so on and so forth. Just before I got to when I got my orders to Vietnam, one of my team members was a guy by the name of Jerry Kropik. Jerry Kropik was a World War II German paratrooper.
Get out.
For real. If you recall, back in the day,
oh, yeah,
we had a lot of skis and eckies and so on and so forth. I mean,
from the Lodge Act.
From the Lodge Act.
Where and foreigners could foreigners, come to right. America to serve in a country first.
Right. And so he was a World War II German paratrooper, wounded in battle at Stalingrad. He went back to Berlin, recuperated, was sent to a little place called Normandy.
No.
Just before the...
the invasion.
The invasion.
Sure.
Long story short, he ended up being a border guard on the Czechoslovakian border after the war, defected, joined the French Foreign Legion, was at Dien Bien Phu. The man had the humor of a pit bull. Those were my mentors. I had gentlemen who were Hungarian freedom fighters. You know the guys that I'm talking about.
I mean, sure, and just for the listeners, the under the Lodge Act, yeah, people from Europe or other countries, they wanted to come to America. They could join the Army, serve in the Army, become U.S. citizens.
That's right.
Because the Cold War was going
full,
on.
Full fling, yes.
We had the 10th Special Forces Group was based in Germany.
Right.
And they had teams that were doing all kinds of work behind the lines there. And they always wanted people that spoke the language,
right,
that were familiar with the customs and the SF tradition. And hence you're at that melting pot.
Oh, yes,
at
we did.
Group.
Oh, yes, we had that. And so I said, Kropik, what's the best advice you could give me? And I have it in the book. He says, you have to overcome your fear of dying and let your training solve the problem of the moment.
Wow.
And so he says, tomorrow we go in the back. And we had, a lot of the groups had a big, huge sand table in the back. And you get your little Mattel toys and so on and so forth and do ambush or do this or so on and so forth. And I did that. And he said, do ambush. And I did it, a classic ambush, by the manual. He looked at it, and he slapped me on top of the head. He said, you die. I says, what do you mean I die? I did everything by the book. I did this, I did that, so on and so forth. He says, yes. But you see the little hill here? You did not put a man up there. That way he could see reaction force. You die. Do again. So I did it again. He rearranged it and everything else. I put my little man on top of the hill there. He looked at it, you die.
What?
He says, you see this little bend to here? You put your man here, he cannot see reaction force in time. You die. Do again.
No kidding.
Yeah. So we went on an FTX. We're out in the Pisgah National Forest. Puts his hand on my shoulder. What do you see? Ambush. I'm kind of wondering, you know. Ambush? Ambush, good. Where machine gun? Oh, up there. Where you hide? Over here. Good. Why here? Well, because he can't see it, blah, 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 so on and so forth. How you attack? There's a blind side over here. Okay. So we'd walk another 50 yards or so. Puts his hand on my shoulder. What do you see? Ambush. Where machine gun? Over there. Blah, 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 the whole thing.
So you can see him.
Now, we walk about 75 yards. I stop. I look at him, ambush. I tell him now. So this is how I learned. This is why I'm still here. Because men like him took time out of their lives to teach a young pup like me.
Young green beret.
Right. And they passed that knowledge on to me. What do you see? What do you hear? What do you smell? And then we would have the team, a lot of these guys are Vietnam veterans. And they would tell us the life there at the A camp. When I got my orders, it said SOA. I go, what does SOA stand for?
Yeah.
Special augmentation. Special operations augmentation.
Right.
So right then and there, I didn't know where we were going to go. What unit, whatever. It was just
special. Hey, what's the time frame there, Gene?
This was latter part of May of 68. You and I were kind of right about the same same time period there. And went through the
In-country
COC course. Fred Zabotosky was there.
No.
Yeah, Fred Zabotosky, Medal of Honor recipient, was one of my instructors. he was my combo instructor back at Bragg. And so reacquainted myself with Fred again. And he said, "Where are you going?" I said, "Not sure yet, but it says SOA." He says, "Pay attention to small unit tactics and get yourself in shape." I go, "Wow, okay."
Because Fred earned a Medal of Honor out at the FOB 2 in Kantum in 1968.
Right.
A few months after talking to you.
That's right.
Indeed. Wow.
So before that, because he was still recuperating.
Oh, is that right? Okay.
Yeah, he was still recuperating from the wounds. And so when I got to, then they said, "Oh, you're going to CNC. What is CNC? Command and control. Command and control what? CNC detachment. But what? Command and control detachment. You're going to Da Nang. So we got to Da Nang, we were all herded into the talk, and there was a SFC that kind of gave the pep talk. And after he gave us the pep talk, he said, "If you guys want out, this is the time."
That's when you had the NDAs you had to sign?
Right, and none of us left. And Sergeant First Class Moises Quiroga took all the radio operators and he said, "I need people in teletype and in message center." He says, "None of you are going to leave until I get." So two of us volunteered and everybody else left. So I was in the message center. I says, "I don't want to be here." He says, "You find your replacement?"
Did you get the briefing about what CNC was all about? Or did he just
we got the briefing, and then he said, you know,
Welcome to the secret war.
Yeah, welcome to the secret war.
Right.
And so I was in the message center, and I ended up having mine was 12 noon to midnight. That was my tour, so to speak, my schedule.
Right.
Monday through Monday. There was no day off.
12-hour shifts,
that was it.
So you're there for a while, and then come August, you received a unique warning, a flash message.
That was the 19th, Monday the 19th.
Of August 68.
August 68. It was sometime around 10:45, if I recall correctly. Teletype writer came up to me and he goes, "I got a Zulu message." I go, "Oh my God."
The Zulu message is a flash.
Flash
message.
Top priority. Has to go directly to the camp commander. So I went ahead and typed it, signed it in, put the time, and I says, "I'll take it to the colonel." Went over to the colonel, Colonel Warren, Jack Warren, knocked on the door, and he show opened up the door and he's butt naked with a 45. 1911 45, and I said, "Sir, I have a Zulu message for you." He says, "It says attack imminent." He looked at it. He says, "I'll take care of it." So I went back to my post. Now it's about 11-ish. He showed up around 11:20 or so. He goes to the back. I get off at 12 midnight. So I don't know what happened. The next night, which is now we're looking Tuesday, now we're looking at the 20th. About the same time, another Zulu message. Master Sergeant Danny West was there. We were bullshitting there. And I look at it. He says, "A Zulu message, attack imminent." Danny West says, "I'll take care of it." And he took it to the colonel. A few minutes later, he shows up and goes right back to the back of the TOC, Tactical Operations Center. Midnight comes, I leave. Now, we had heard through the grapevine that there was an enemy regiment or unit south of Marble Mountain, somewhere between 1.5 to 2 miles. It wasn't until later that we found out that it was a 23rd NVA regiment.
Regiment.
And that the 3rd Marine Amtrak, which is south of Marble Mountain, and made contact with them. And the NVA was trying not to engage them. They were trying to just not engage. We had heard also that one of our Hatchet Force companies that was in training had gotten into a small, short furball with one of the units of the 23rd NVA regiment.
But again, the NVA fought when they wanted to.
Right. But they were mostly just, they did not really want to engage. So Thursday, again, about the same time, quarter till, I had left my post to do something. I forgot what it was. And Bill Barkley, who was an teletype operator at the time, got the Zulu message and took it to
Colonel Warren.
Colonel Warren mentioned to him that it's all taken care of by Major Moore. Barkley comes back and says, Major Moore, Colonel says that you have it in control. He says, yes. He says, but it says attack imminent. He says, oh, we get messages like that all the time. So he dismisses it. He says, besides, private, because Barkley was a private at the time, and Major Moore had this condescending tone when he dealt with subordinates.
Peasants.
Yes. He says, listen to me, private. The NVA, the Viet Cong, don't have a navy, so they're not going to come in through the east side. We have Marble Mountain, we have a friendly village, and we have the 3rd Marine Amtrak, so they're not going to attack us from the south. We have a garbage dump on the west side of the camp. And on the north side, we have a North Vietnamese prisoner of war camp, and we have another special forces camp, and we have the 3rd Marine Air Base. So, Sergeant, I don't think they're going to attack us.
Oh. So you go to bed.
So at midnight, I go to bed.
And we should also add at that time, that day, during the day, there had been a promotion board.
That's correct.
And earlier in the month of August, the command and control center that had been at Da Nang Air Base was moved into FOB-4, into the headquarters office.
That's correct.
Bringing more personnel on base. So with that in mind, you go to bed. It's now August 23rd, early morning hours. You're sound asleep?
Sound asleep. About 2:30, somewhere between 2:15, 2:30. It's depending on who's looking at the watch at the time.
Indeed.
There was a muffled explosion. In fact, there were just a couple of them. I got up, and then we started hearing some AK-47 fire. In what we called the longhouse barracks, we had 5 rooms on each side, and the doors were offset of this center hallway.
Right.
I looked out the door, and I saw this homemade VC grenade. Now, homemade VC grenades have a time fuse of 0 to 20 seconds.
I forgot the 20 part.
Yeah, they're between 0 and 20. Somewhere in there, it's going to go off.
Right.
You know, it's not like ours where you pull it, and 6 seconds later, it's going to explode. No, 0 to 20. By that time, the visitors that I had in my room, because I was part of the transient barracks at the time.
Right.
I had Sergeant John Dodd sleeping on the top bunk. There were 2 lieutenants, Lieutenant Donald Dahl, who I think you have personal experience with.
Oh, yes, sir.
And Lieutenant Paul Potter. And we had a captain, Mike Lamb, on the other side. There was another person in there, but I don't know who that other person was. And I said, grenade. And we wait. And Lieutenant Dahl says, well, where is this freaking grenade? So he goes out to the door with me, and the damn thing goes off. Now, I believe the way we were standing that he got the brunt of whatever shrapnel.
Right.
That just the way we were standing, I got some shrapnel in my right shoulder and my arm. And right about that time, there was a massive explosion. Massive. Knocked us all on the ground. Of course, it's dark, and we're saying, is everybody okay? Everybody okay? Dahl says, the son of a bitch is going down to the other end of the building. He puts on his pants. I already have my pants on, and I can still see him, bare-chested, barefoot, going down the hall. He goes out, and I hear his bang, bang. And he goes, got you, son of a bitch. The next thing I hear is, I'm hit. So I go out. Now, Dahl is short. He's kind of like a weightlifter, kind of a gymnast or something, a wrestler. No neck.
That was indeed his nickname.
Was his nickname. No neck. And I weigh about 135 pounds soaking wet. And he outweighs me a good 30, 40 pounds.
At least. Yeah.
So I'm out there, and I'm trying to drag, pull him, and I could feel the bullets snap right by my bare torso here and by my head. They're just snapping and dirt kicking up right up at the foot, trying to kill him and me. And I'm dragging him, and he's kicking with his good leg because he was shot in the leg. And we get to the door frame, and the door frame literally just explodes. And I was going to put him into the first room, and I put him in the second room. And I yelled for a medic. And out of nowhere, out of the darkness, this medic appears.
Really?
Yeah. And based on what we've talked about before on his description, we figured that it was George Bacon. I never saw his face. Shortly thereafter, Melville Westerfield shows up. His hair was combed. I mean, he had his uniform on, like if he was on parade. Runs in, grabs his gear, and I'm yelling at him, don't go out. You're going to get killed. And he goes out, and he runs. He survives, by the way. I go across the hall to the front room now. Give cover. Anybody coming in? And all of a sudden, the captain shows up, Captain Lamb. Now, mind you, he's Oriental. And he came that close to getting shot. But I had seen him.
He's early. Only wearing a shirt.
Yeah, he's wearing his uniform. He's got his bars and everything else. And that's what saved him.
Yeah.
And I looked at him and I said, Captain, you better stick close to me because someone's going to shoot your ass. And he goes, yes. I said, hold here. I'm going to go across and check on the lieutenant. By this time.
But now you got incoming from mortars.
We're getting mortars, getting explosions.
Machine
and everything.
Gun fired down.
Everything is just, it was just hell. Just hell outside. So I go across, check on the lieutenant, and I hear a sound of someone coming down the hallway. And all of a sudden, I see a figure.
Silhouette?
A silhouette, but I can't tell who it is. I can't tell if it's one of us, one of our guys being very cautious or what. But he's there in the door frame. And all of a sudden, there's an explosion. There's an explosion there from the talk. The old wooden talk.
Right.
That was in the center of camp, and it lit him up. He's got brown, tan shorts. He's got a belt across his chest, and he's got an AK-47. Now, it lights him up, but guess what? It lights me up.
Have you ever wondered what happened to legendary Chuck Norris? He's in his 80s and still is kicking butt and working out and staying active. What's even more shocking is he's stronger, can work out longer, and even has plenty of energy left over for his grandkids. He did this by just making one change. He says he still feels like he's in his 50s. His wife even started doing this one thing too, and she's never felt better. She says she feels 10 years younger, her body looks leaner, and she has energy all day. Chuck's made a 20-minute video explaining step-by-step how anyone can do the same thing to see incredible changes in their health. Go to mymorningkick.com/SOG and watch Chuck's video right now. Again, that's mymorningkick.com/SOG.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from Corient. Corient provides wealth management services centered around you. They focus on exceeding your expectations and simplifying your life. Corient has been helping high achievers just like you enjoy their lives more fully, preserve their wealth, and provide for the people, causes, and communities they care about. As one of the largest integrated fee-only registered investment advisors in the U.S., Corient has deeply experienced teams in 23 strategic locations. Corient has extensive knowledge spanning the full spectrum of planning, investing, lending, and money management disciplines. Leverage Corient's exclusive network of experts to craft custom solutions designed to help you reach your financial goals, no matter how complex they may be. Real wealth requires real solutions. For more information, connect with a wealth advisor today at Corient.com. That's Corient.com. Corient.com.
What's the easiest choice you can make? Window instead of middle seat? Picking a vendor who sends a great gift basket? Outsourcing business tasks you hate? What about selling with Shopify? Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage, all the way to the did-we-just-hit-a-million-orders stage, Shopify's there to help you grow. Whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, Shopify helps you sell. Wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/try. Go to shopify.com/try now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/try.
Oh, no.
So right then and there, we both, and then of course it goes black. Now I think what saved me was the fact that that flash blinded him. I believe so. And of course there's the element of God too.
Indeed.
And we both shoot at each other. Bang, bang. Two shots apiece. He falls. And then we hear a voice on from the outside saying, hey, everybody, or anybody heard, come outside. I said, we're going to take the lieutenant out. He says, Captain, you cover us. So we get ready to lift up Lieutenant Dahl. And all of a sudden, we drop him because I kind of wince. I said, ouch. And the medic says, what the hell do you have on your shoulder? I says, I don't know. So he starts feeling in the dark, and I've got wood splinters on my left shoulder. So he starts yanking them out. And he says, get yourself to the dispensary afterwards. I says, yes, but let's get the hell out of here.
Yeah.
I didn't quite say that, but anyway. this is a PG-13, right?
Oh, no, no. Okay. You can say fornication once in a while.
But anyway, I said, well, what the fornication then?
Yeah.
So we got out of there. So I said, Captain, cover us. So we go down the hall, and there's a fire in my room. I did not know at the time that it was my duffel bag that was on fire. And so we went outside, and there was a man throwing Kaufman on top of the hood of the Jeep. Did not know it at the time that it was Pat Watkins.
No kidding.
Yeah. And this man is yelling at Kaufman and saying, Kaufman, if you don't me, so help me God, I'm going to kill you. Which I thought was logical.
Indeed.
Yeah. So we put the lieutenant in the front seat. John Dodd is in the back seat. And Sergeant Scully is looking at me and he goes, you're wounded. And I kind of look around. I guess I am. But
Splinters. My God.
You know? And so there was a Hispanic guy there. And I spoke with Doug Gudshaw. And we figured there's a guy that from Mylock that was down there.
Really?
Yeah.
Okay.
And so he's also wounded. And he goes, go to the dispensary. So I go to the dispensary with him. I'm right behind the Jeep. He's going like a bat out of hell to the Jeep, to the dispensary. I get there. And there's this guy on the ground. And he's got a big hole on his side. And I look at myself and I'm going, I don't need to be here. You know, I don't need to be here. So I leave. So we start make our way back and we're there by the motor pool and the ground starts to erupt. And we hug the ground, myself and this Hispanic looking guy. And I look up. And there's this guy that's falling off the water tower. Then it goes dark. In the meantime, right about that time, there's two Jeeps that go by, kind of crisscross each other. And they're drawing fire, and I shoot. And either I don't think I hit him, but I think I scared him. And then get back to the to where we were before. And And Colonel Donald Smith, the FOB 2 commander.
He's up there for part of the...
For the staff
monthly
meeting. Yeah.
Monthly meeting.
And he shows up and he says, there was a machine gun by the S-4. He says, take care of it. So myself, I go up there and I go by the corner of the senior NCO barracks.
And what are you carrying, an M-16, Car 15?
No, I had an M-2 carbine.
Carbine, okay.
Right.
Yeah.
And I peek around the corner and I can see the muzzle flash. So I engage. And right at the time that the fire stops, there's an explosion. Now, I don't know if I hit somebody or scared them or the explosion got them. I don't know because it was like nanoseconds.
Right.
You know, one of those things. And I look up and there's this huge black guy. And he says, I used to be an all-Army pitcher.
Wow.
So I gave him all my grenades except for one. I kept one. And a nanosecond later, here comes Colonel Warren. And he looks at me and he goes, your position is at the top. Get your butt up there and hold that position until relieved. So I made my way up by the generator. Started going up towards the talk, and Ray Sinkiewicz was up there. Now, Ray is about 6'1", 6'2".
Right. Big Ray.
Big guy. And I'm going up there, and I says, Ray, it's me. Don't shoot. It's me. And there's two dead VC there that he shot, and Bill Barkley's behind the generator. And I says, hey, I just spoke with the colonel. We're to hold this position until relieved. He says, okay, let's go to the bunkers, if you recall the bunkers across the street.
Right.
So that's where we went. Was there for a while.
Had the S-4 exploded yet?
Was shortly afterwards. Shortly okay. After it exploded, a big, huge, I mean, big stuff.
Oh, huge explosion.
Big thing exploded. And then, again, time is... And I couldn't tell you the time. I can't tell you the time. All I know was there was an ambulance that went bat out of hell And I found out later that Lieutenant Travis Mills was a door gunner on that. And we were still getting explosions throughout the camp. Mortars, satchel charges and grenades and what have you.
And they had machine guns.
And they had machine guns. They had RPDs. And then there was the flare went up, and there was a group of men running towards the front. And I was about to engage, and one of them was wearing red pajamas. And I'm going, no upstanding VC is going to wear red pajamas. So I didn't engage. Again, I can't tell you the time.
Sure.
But then a Jeep showed up, all shot up, and we think it was Lieutenant Blatherwick. We think it was Blatherwick.
Yeah, because he made several trips with that Jeep.
Right. And he asked if we had any wounded or anything like that. And we said no, and then he took off.
When did you find out about Lieutenant Potter?
Later on in the morning.
Later, okay.
I wanted to go back to my room. And they had already moved the body, but there was the blood. A lot of blood. And don't recall who it was. He says, who was in this room? I said, that's my room. He says, well, there was an officer there. He got killed. And that's when I found out. And there was a pool of blood in the hallway, because there was no body there in the hallway where I shot the guy. But there was a pool of blood there. And there was a blood trail. And then I started going over to the dispensary. To the mess hall. And there was this huge explosion there by one of the shitters.
Over on the north side by the NVA camp?
Yeah, it was over. It was on by the recon area.
Right.
By the recon, they just blew up, sending shit all over the place.
Literally.
And then had a cup of coffee.
So by now, you've gone through a period of 5 or 6 hours, because now you've got sunlight.
Sunlight.
The attack was launched around 2 a.m.
Right. And so now we're kind of seeing the aftermath. And there were bodies everywhere. There were two bodies by the old talk, beyond recognition. Just, you didn't know who it was.
Sure.
Later I found out they were the bodies of Bobby Wasaka and Talmadge Alfin. They were my Como brothers. I went through Como school with them.
No kidding.
Yeah. So I knew them.
Sure.
But I did not know that at the time, because they were just charred remains there.
Of course, also the mortar fire had stopped because Larry Trimble and his recon team up on the mountain.
Larry...
The same of the day, actually.
He was, without Larry, I would not be here talking to you. Larry saved the camp. I don't care what anybody else says. He saved the camp. He took out the two mortar pits, positions that were there, and he repelled anywhere between 4 to 6 ground assaults up there.
On his position.
On his position. Right. Had the NVA controlled the high ground, they would have put up their all sorts of equipment up there, mortars, machine guns, God knows what. They would have wiped us out.
There would have been more than 16 Green
More
Berets
than 16. There would have been more than 16.
Absolutely.
Absolutely more. And so Larry, he's very humble about it. He's very humble. And he took care of business. He took care of business. And again, as far as I'm concerned, he is the hero.
Sure.
Period. Period. There were acts of documented heroism that night, and there were acts of undocumented heroism that night. Some people ask me, says, well, where was the command structure? We didn't have any. It was pockets of the young NCOs and the young officers that took over the camp.
And the Indige.
And the Indige. Now, the Indige, bless their hearts, there was two machine gun nests or positions, NVA positions, because there were NVA. It wasn't VC. It was NVA, hardcore NVA, the 22nd Sapper Battalion. And they were there to kill us. They were there to die.
These guys were, in fact, they came in just with their loincloth, and their bandana said that.
Yeah.
We came here to die. Yeah.
And they were hardcore. And they set up an RPD right there by the Hatchet Force. And anybody that came out of that Hatchet Force barracks, they just mowed them down. We had 16 Americans that were KIA. We had 40 Vietnamese that were KIA.
At least 40.
And we had over 78 WIA wounded in action. I mean, that's how many. I mean,
sure.
So that was it. We had supposedly, I know that we had, I think it was 38 confirmed killed, body count, NVA. A couple of days later, seven more bodies were dug up near the south fence because, remember, this was beach.
Right, oh, sure.
And so they just threw sand on them. And about 3 or 4 days later, those bodies started to percolate. And the smell of death was throughout the camp. The Marines reported to us that there was, and I either 17 or 21 freshly dug graves by the village there. And
so the other side of Marble Mountain.
On the other side of Marble Mountain, yeah. And so that was it. Later on, we found out that we were the diversionary action. Our camp was a diversionary action. The actual attack, the purpose of the attack, was to free prisoners of the POW camp.
That was just to the north?
Just to the north.
On the other side of the minefield.
Right. They were there to free them. And I don't know how many prisoners they were going to free, but they were going to free the whole lot. And what saved us was the fact that when our camp got attacked, a reaction, Marine reaction force from the Marble Mountain Air Base came south on Highway 1, and they ran into an element there.
Yeah, and then one of the lieutenants, I can't think of his name right now, but he also, at some point, a gunship came in, and he was able to direct gunfire
right
on that perimeter between FOB4, the minefield,
right,
and then the NVA POW camp.
Correct. Right.
Without that, if they had broken those prisoners out.
Oh, yeah. We would have been in deep doo-doo. Keep kimchi if you were in Korea.
But indeed.
Deep doo-doo, yes, that's for sure. So shortly after that, I found my replacement and went on to the recon teams.
Welcome to RTS.
RTS. And when I first met Tony had just come back from Daniel Boone down in Cambodia. And he had gotten drugged through the trees. Anyway, he was coming out on strings. Helicopters start getting gunfire. And instead of going up high, no, they just dragged him.
Through the trees. Made him a human pinball.
Human being pinball. He had two black eyes, a broken nose, had a big, huge rope burn across his neck, and had black and blue marks everywhere. I mean, he looked gorgeous. I mean, just absolutely. I tease him about it all the time.
Oh, yeah.
And so he looked just absolutely gorgeous. And when I first got on the team, and of course, he's there in the barracks, and we were having a formation. Frank Piccoli, president accounted for. He says, where's Bandolero?
Right.
Says, hey, Pew, he's your 1-0. Go and get him. So I go over there and I says, Sergeant Major wants to see you now. He says, I'm not going to go. Sergeant Major wants to see you. So here comes Tony, butt naked. Butt naked. All he's got is his flip-flops. Reports, Sergeant Major Vickers just looks at him and he goes, you've got 5 minutes to get dressed and get your ass up on Marble Mountain. You've got 4 minutes now. So, but yeah, that was life in recon.
Indeed,
that was life in recon, and so we had characters, and
so how long were you on ASP then?
I was the entire duration.
Okay,
I was an ASP. I strapped hung on. Sidewinder and got weathered out. We went to Fubai and didn't go in. And that was it. That was my only, when I was assigned to RASP, that was the only time I went, I was asked to, you know, strap hang with, you know, with, right. with another team. And it was with Sidewinder and went to Fubai, weather, came back. That was it.
So your tour of duty wraps up, and then what's next for you in your career?
Went back to college.
You got out of the Army?
Got out of the Army. I was going to stay, and this is where it gets kind of interesting. I went home to Panama. Actually, let me take it back to where I was in Seattle.
After you returned from Vietnam.
I got DROS there, and of course I could wear my uniform for 3 days, you know, for travel purposes. I was at the Seattle-Tacoma Airport, and there was another sergeant with me.
Could we turn to your book?
Sure.
Because you captured that one little scene in there.
Yes, I wrote it in the book, yes.
Absolutely. I was going to use that for the ending, but now that we're here, you all come to the airport.
Right.
And you're walking through the airport, and I was turning to the book now. The next morning, as they walked down the concourse to the gate, they spotted a long-haired, bearded individual with a leather vest passing out flowers to passengers. He spotted the two Special Forces troopers in their dress greens with all their decorations and badges. Hey, Green Beret, just back from the war? Show me the medal you got for raping women. How do you feel? How did it feel to squash a baby's head? The man pointed to Purvis' chest full of ribbons. Of course, that's Quinn.
Well, that's me, actually.
That's you? Okay.
That's me.
That's why I wanted clarification on your fiction.
Yeah.
So Purvis and Walters were taken by surprise by the verbal insult. Then Purvis stepped forward and looked deep into the man's green eyes, and through gritted teeth said, Mister, I've never killed a man in anger. Please don't be the first. So welcome to Seattle.
Yeah.
Oh, my that? God.
The guy was dead and he didn't even know it.
Yeah. Absolutely.
So when I got home, I saw my mother. And my mother had aged so much.
Because your brother was in the Air Force at the right. time, too. So he's worried about both of you.
And so I was thinking of re-upping. I really did. I really thought of, you know, staying back in, jumping out of airplanes and doing my thing. But I couldn't do it to her.
No kidding.
I couldn't do it. I just couldn't do it. Because she would have died. She would have, I would have killed her. And, I mean, inadvertently, I would have killed
right.
her. Right. And I couldn't do it. I just couldn't do it.
So then you're off, what's next in your life there? Back to school?
Back to school. I was a teacher in Washington, D.C. Became a pilot. Came here to Dallas, was employed by Peregrine International, George Petrie, and had an interesting...
Of course, just say, give us a little history of George.
George, he was a company commander with two Corps Mike 4s. He was a Sante Raider. A legend. Awesome character.
Oh, yeah, one of the Sox legends all time.
Oh, yeah.
And plus Sante.
Oh, yeah, Sante Raider. Oh, yeah, definitely. I mean, so George, my passport at the time had some interesting stamps on it. Panama, Guatemala, Salvador, Mexico, Venezuela. Yeah, all sorts of places.
But they didn't put down Laos or Cambodia.
No, they didn't. No, no.
Didn't make it.
No. In fact, I was persona non grata in Nicaragua.
Is that right?
For real.
So later in your career, at some point, how'd you wind up down there in 1989?
With George.
Of course. That's what I'm
George,
saying.
Right?
Yeah, so give us a little background on that.
We were security for Ambassador Jean Kirkpatrick. And
she was a dynamo.
Dynamo. I mean, that woman had iron panties, I'll tell you that.
Absolutely.
Dynamo, she was smart, quick, and very, very, very perceptive. And the reason she was there was to basically prevent, and she did it.
And how many of you all were there for her bodyguards?
Three.
Three of you.
George Petrie, Kay Tenner, and a guy named Gene Pugh. That was it. And we had to get the 14 people out of Nicaragua under the nose of the Secret Service into Guatemala for 2 or 3 days and then reinsert them back again.
And say why?
Because what it was Ambassador Kirkpatrick was to make this coalition of the 14 parties that would support one candidate against Daniel Ortega, which they did. It was Violeta Chamorro, who ended up being president of Nicaragua, and she defeated Daniel Ortega.
Which was a major stunning upset for the communists.
Oh, yes, big time.
Oh, yeah. So you're there, Aldous Protection Unit, you get to know her. How long did you do that kind of work that led to other things on your passport?
We did some things along the border, the U.S.-Mexican border. We went to Venezuela. There was a fraud deal that was going on, and turned out to be that fraud went all the way back to Spain.
Venezuela?
From Venezuela. And it was dealing with some bad guys that were supporting terrorism groups. And so then the feds took over.
So, but you and George got some initial groundwork?
Got the initial groundwork on that. And so then that was taken away from us because then it became a federal deal.
Okay, but you guys did the initial work that
was
able to expose some of that. So, right. Mr. Modesty, could you just give us a little smidge more on what was going on? How did you even begin to get into that? My God.
By accident.
Naturally.
By accident. The thing about it was George would... Whenever we would go to Central America, my cover was, I came from Panama, which is true.
True.
Because I speak Spanish with a Panamanian accent. I'm not Mexican or Puerto Rican or whatever.
Right.
I came from Panama. And when I was in Venezuela, I was challenged. And first time I've ever been challenged. And I was able to defend myself because everything I said was true. Because I lived there in Calle 7 in Santa Isabel, and I knew El Chinito, and I knew Leloy there on Avenida Melendez, and so on and so forth. So everything was down pat.
So you're challenged by some bad guy?
A bad guy, yeah.
All right, so give us a little bit more action here, buddy. What did you do? You had to do your investigation at some point, the feds come in?
We were doing our investigations. It was a money laundering scheme.
Okay.
That's basically what it was. They were selling Venezuelan treasury notes. And one of the guys up here in Texas bought some, found out that they were fraudulent. And so we were trying to get it resolved for him to get his money back and what have you. So we went down. He paid us to go down to Venezuela. When we were there, we met another entity there who was working on the same thing. And so then they said, no, it's going to be a federal deal. So we gave it to them.
So I'm still dying to hear it. Let's back the tape up just a little bit. Mexican-U.S. border?
Yes.
Your NDAs are far, you're far past those now. You could talk a little bit about that.
Okay. There was, we had suspect that there was a bad guy in the, in the Border Patrol deal.
Oh, no.
Yeah. And so George and I, so they created a identity for George. And so George and I was there as a six, basically to cover his back. And George went in there, and another friend of ours has passed away, Zach Watson, went there one or two times.
So we were able to find the perp?
We were able to find the perp.
Get a probable cause for arrest?
Yeah, at that time, yes. Because
or just a removal?
I don't know the what it was there, but yeah, it was interesting.
Okay, well, move along. How long did you work with George? And then what was the next in your career after that,
I worked
sir?
With George for about 3 or 4 years. Very interesting. Interesting. In fact, my last assignment, we were in Panama in 89, and we were at the Hotel Veracruz, and we saw this group going, and I said, hey, ¿a dónde vas? I said, Noriega. He's going to talk there at the Parque Porras. George says, let's go. I said, no, we don't want to go there. Come on, Pew, come on. Nah, I don't want to go. So George gets up, and I'm not going to let him go there by himself, so I go with George. So we're away in the back, and George gives me that grin, and I knew it was trouble. He says, see how close you can get up to him. Okay, coach, okay. Like a dumb idiot. So I worked my way up. Now, mind you, at that time, I was wearing a white long sleeve guayabera shirt, black pants, short haircut, mustache. I worked my way down, and there's this barricade of sawhorses. And right across from me is a guy with a white guayabera shirt, black pants, black, dark mustache, part of the security. So I figured, what the hell?
Sure.
So I'm looking at him, and I kind of gave him the look, you know, like. So I kind of back into the crowd, and I kind of disappear in the crowd, come back and go. So I go like that. So I disappear into the crowd, come back, give him the note, and goes, okay. And then for some stupid reason, which I still cannot understand why I did it, but you know how you do stupid things?
Oh, indeed.
Yeah.
I may have had one or two in my life.
I'm glad. I go underneath the sawhorse, and I stand right next to him. I say, ¿todo está bien? Todo está bien. Okay, muy bien. So I park myself over there by the stairs, and this woman is there, and all of a sudden, Noriega comes down the stairs. Walks on out. I walk my way back up to where George is. George goes, we go back to the hotel. He gets a phone call. And I'm like where we are right now, and all I hear is, yes, sir. Yes, sir. No, sir. No, sir. Yes, sir. No, sir. No, sir. Yes, sir. Yes, sir. Yes, sir. We're not going to do that shit anymore. Now, evidently, someone knew George. And I'm kind of going into what it might have been like.
Sure, okay.
You know, I'm just kind of getting my imagination here.
It's more of your fiction.
More of my fiction, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
It probably goes something like this. Hey, there's George. Who's the guy with the mustache? Anybody recognize him? Where in the hell is the guy in the mustache? Where is he going? Where is the guy in the mustache? Where is he going? Oh, my God. No. Oh, my God. That dumb, stupid. Oh, crap. Shit. Where is he? He's in the front. Oh, crap. Oh, God. Where is he now?
And then Noriega comes down.
And then he goes, where is he? He's there by the stairs. Oh, crap. Shit. Damn. That screws up the entire operation. He's screwing up the entire operation. Where's Noriega? He left. Where's the guy with the mustache? Where's George? There he is. Keep an eye on George. Keep an eye on that guy in the mustache. Where is he? And all of a sudden, oh, they're over at the Veracruz. What's the number for the Veracruz? Señor Petri, por favor. And there's where the conversation, again, I'm just.
Sure.
Because George never told me.
Really?
Who was on the other end. He never told me. I went to see my mother. My mother at that time was in a nursing home. I went to see her the next morning. And when I came back, George wasn't there, and he showed up a couple of hours later, about an hour or so later. Never told me where he was, where he went. And then he said, repeat how you got up there, what you did. So I told him again. He says, okay. He says, we're not going to do that anymore. He says, okay, I got that. That was it. I have no clue. No clue.
So after your career with George,
I became a personal trainer and did that for a while. And then
you forgot a little detail on it. Some words you ran to this lovely lady, Phyllis.
Yes, yes, yes. I'm in Virginia. Married her 47 years.
47?
47, yeah.
Wow.
She's my life.
She's a saint, you ain't.
I know. She is my life. I mean, period. She is my life, period.
And, beauty and brains, wrapped in one package.
And so then after I quit Bally Total Fitness, I was a personal trainer, started working for Tony Bandiera.
No.
Yeah, I did. Started working for him.
I remember those days, the good wine.
Good wine and good liquor and everything else. And then retired from there. I wouldn't say I retired. I was medically retired. I had an open heart surgery. I had a 5-graft bypass.
I remember that.
Yeah, it was scary. And,
a lot of praying going on.
Oh, yeah. And trust me, I believe in prayers.
It's the new you.
Yeah, I believe in prayers. I've always believed in prayers.
Indeed.
And in fact, God listened to my mother's prayers. And that's why I'm still here, too.
I believe it.
You know, mother's prayers are very, very strong. And my mother's prayers were answered.
Indeed. So any more professional chores along the way before or after the heart surgery? Or now you're kind of pretending just to be an author?
You've got
two books out and you're working on number three now.
Number three. I've actually written five. The other two are waiting to be edited, so to speak.
Indeed.
Indeed. I've written screenplays. I've written...
So stop being so modest. Your first book is Surrender Not an Option. Your second book is...
It's called The Reunion Mission.
And the third book that's going to come out?
The Diplomat.
There you go.
The Diplomat. And I've written a 12-episodic screenplay based on Surrender Not an Option.
And by the way, these are all available on Amazon.
On Amazon, and so is Reunion Mission.
Okay.
And also what it is, the episodic, there's some fictional characters, but mostly Purvis and Waters and so on and so forth, but they represent the 1-0s, so to speak. And then I have stories of the Frenchman. I have the stories of Blackjack. I have the stories of a guy named Tilt.
Some knucklehead.
Knuckle dragger
for sure. Yeah, personified.
And so on and so forth. And I've got Jimmy Shorten. And so I've got their stories in there woven into this narrative of 12 episodes.
Very good. So anything else, sir?
And that's about it.
Final thoughts as we get ready to turn off the mics and enjoy life a little bit here in lovely downtown Dallas?
Basically, we stand on the shoulders. We did.
Absolutely.
The younger generation is standing on our shoulders, mainly because every 20 years or so, every generation, they have to be tested. And we look back from the World War II generation, and they looked at us and they said, are we worth it? Are you worthy of the torch? And we look at this new generation, and I've looked at them. The new Marsoc, the new Green Berets and what have you. They're worth it.
Very indeed. Much so.
The torch has been passed on, and they will pass it on to the next generation, and they will be tested. And America, it's ours. And if we lose it, where do we go?
Indeed. With that, we want to say thanks to all the men and women in our armed services who have fought and bled for this country. We also thank Border Patrol, law enforcement, first responders, EMT, corrections officers. And as always, we thank Jocko Willink Productions for sponsoring Sogcast interviews and for covering all the costs for production and flights. And we thank the men and women who have served our country today and for the men and women who served in the past, like heroes like Gene Pugh. And we also remember and salute the men and women who have not returned from the Vietnam War from Southeast Asia. Today, we have 1,579 Americans still MIA from the Vietnam War. That includes 50 Green Berets who were killed in action and remain missing in action from the Secret War. And we've documented at least 83 aviators who died in support of the Green Berets during that 8-year Secret War. Again, we thank Jocko. God bless America.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from Corient. Corient provides wealth management services centered around you. They focus on exceeding your expectations and simplifying your life. Corient has been helping high achievers just like you enjoy their lives more fully, preserve their wealth, and provide for the people, causes, and communities they care about. As one of the largest integrated fee-only registered investment advisors in the U.S., Corient has deeply experienced teams in 23 strategic locations. Corient has extensive knowledge spanning the full spectrum of planning, investing, lending, and money management disciplines. Leverage Corient's exclusive network of experts to craft custom solutions designed to help you reach your financial goals, no matter how complex they may be. Real wealth requires real solutions. For more information, connect with a wealth advisor today at Corient.com. That's Corient.com. Corient.com.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.